Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Monday edition of the Daily Trench Show. Probably the more used to make here, but I'm Nick Larimer. Nick Larimer is otherwise imposed. I believe he had some judgments concluded over the weekend, so he asked me to stand in for him. So I'm sure he'll be back tomorrow, but I'm not alone today as usual. I'm joined by Sarah Gunn. Sarah, how are you?
Good, thanks. Hi, Marius.
And I'm also joined by steadfast Harriman Pretorius. How's it going, Harriman?
I must say, no. When you said steadfast, I thought you just meant fast, because I, as viewers might be able to see, I'm now considerably more aerodynamic than I was in the previous episode when I started to resemble, you know, something of a cleaning implement. But no, I must say, I'm glad to be here, and I had a fun weekend because I met two loyal Daily Friend listeners by happenstance. And so I dedicate my participation in this episode to Philip Calcott and Juliet Calcott, who just hosted a wonderful, wonderful, space camp weekend thingy. So, Philip, Juliet, thank you very, very much for a lovely weekend, and we hope you enjoy these episodes, further. So, yes.
So that's also to any of our listeners or viewers. If you see a member of the Daily Friend team out and about, come say hello, and maybe also get a shout out on the show. So, but let's get on to more serious matters. So with the issue of the amendment to the Constitution to allow for expropriation without compensation is still chugging along through Parliament and what have you. And who knows exactly what's happening, but seems to be the ANC seems to be changing their mind a lot on this. We saw Paul Mashatile come out this weekend, I think it was this weekend or very recently, saying expropriation without compensation is not a good idea. Ronald Lamola also said something, the Minister of Justice said something similar to that. But it seems that there are still some shenanigans going on with that. It seems that the ANC seems to be, trying to amend the amendment itself, and some things are not very good amendments. Harriman, do you want to tell us a bit about that, and what is the ANC up to? Why are they doing this?
Yeah, so everyone should be vaguely aware of the fact that this committee, this ad hoc parliamentary committee, was established a few years ago from a mandate from the National Assembly to amend Section 25, and the rhetoric that was used was to make that which is implicit explicit, you know, to say that Section 25 already accommodates the concept of a nil compensation or zero compensation or no compensation. Those things, you know, people might quibble about them, but they essentially mean we take your land or your property and you get nothing back. So whatever you want to call it, it's the absence of something. And then to develop that into a feasible amendment, that was the job of the committee. This ad hoc committee, of course, led by the parliamentary majority, the ANC. Now, this process has been a long time coming within the ANC, but over the last year, it has really, taken some substantive steps towards actually becoming the first ever amendment to the Bill of Rights in South Africa to weaken property rights, and one could delve into the reasons for that. But the reality is we are now closer to the Bill of Rights being amended than we've ever been since its inception in 1996, or its, predecessor in the interim constitution in 1993. And it has not been a pleasant ride for anyone. For those opposing the amendment, it has been frustrating because the process has been, marred by some significant question marks. For example, Parliament receiving almost 500,000 written submissions, but not coming close to considering 500,000 of them in terms of its committee doing the work to understand, where the public is on this. And of course, the IRR being responsible for, I think, roughly just over half of those submissions, deep into the 250,000. That has been a dissatisfying process, but the ANC hasn't gotten it all its way. A few weeks ago, when the committee actually arrived at a point of having a draft amendment bill ready, the 18th such amendment to our constitution, the first to our Bill of Rights, it transpired that it only has the support of the ANC in committee. The EFF refused to support it, the IFP refused to support it. And those are two parties that have either been squishy on this issue or blatantly aggressive. The IFP have been a bit squishy on this. They've spoken out of both parts of their mouths a bit here. And the EFF have just been blatantly aggressive, saying this does not go far enough. And that's, I think, a typical trope you'll always see in EFF rhetoric, is nothing is ever extreme enough for them, and it gives them the convenience of, perpetual spectatorship, so that they can always just carp on about the lack of ideological purity and how other people other than them are sellouts. So when the ANC tried to get this amendment bill through committee to get to the National Assembly to be voted on to try and establish a two-thirds majority, it transpired that the party support wasn't there to get it through to that point. So ever since, the chair of the committee, Dr. Mofteka, has been doing a bit of a tango to try and accommodate the EFF and the IFP and perhaps even the UDM in getting them on board a version of an amendment bill to Section 25. And the latest, perverse acrobatics, legislatively speaking, that this committee has tried to, pull off, has been firstly to immunize essentially traditional land ownership structures like the Ingonyama Trust and similar entities from the repercussions of this bill. Clearly, we are seeing the influence of the House of Traditional Leaders. Now, some people call it the Third Chamber of Parliament. It's no such thing. It's, just a very expensive hobby. And when I say it's a hobby, expensive, it's of course paid for by the taxpayer. But for the rest, it's just, a tribal dress and debate for the sake of it. It's like the House of Lords, but even more irrelevant and dozy. So the traditional land ownership structures are now somehow exempt from this bizarre iteration. And then the big one is that instead of the 1913 date of the 1913 Natives Land Act being the point from which some sort of retributionist or reparative timeline can run, it now goes back more than a century earlier to the year 1800. So any land occupation since the year 1800 to present will now be, debatable or contestable under this piece of legislation. And when asked in committee, Dr. Mofteka, why this 1800 arbitrary date, he said, well, that is the time when black South Africans realized that they wanted to own property. And I just think that that's such a collective, it's imaginative, masturbatory legislative processes, because you're just like, something needs to happen. It doesn't make sense. We're not getting into a, consensual relationship here. So let's just, pull it out of the air. So this nonsense of the 1800 date now being the point at which, injustice kicked in en masse is absolutely arbitrary. It's absolutely random. And it is clear gymnastics from the ANC in Parliament, perhaps not in Cabinet, to get this thing through and save some face. But it is just, I think, it's what one might call a cluster copulation.
but the one thing that's interesting for me is if traditional land or traditionally owned land is going to be exempt from this, does that mean that somebody can go approach the British High Commission and say they'd like to give their property to the British Crown and say, no, it's also been owned by a traditional leader? A traditional leader might be sitting in London rather than in the Transkei, for example, but does that mean your property will now be safe from this mighty state that we have that seems to want to control everything? But let me come to you.
Now might be a good time to look up the descendants of the Voortrekker leaders and just become friends with them. I mean, there's a real incentive here that they might become land barons very, very soon.
Exactly. So, Sarah, what are the implications of this? Does this mean that because this is quite a big change to this proposed amendment, does this mean that there's going to have to be public hearings again and what have you? And, do you think they're just going to be able to push it through? Are you muted?
Just trying to keep the dreaded hard eliza back. I think Annelie Lothrit of the DAMP into Agriculture and Land described it quite as an unprecedented act of parliamentary process manipulation, which I think is a kind of way of just saying pretty much what Herman has just said. And she says that this clause to go to 1800 was essentially smuggled into the draft law without the knowledge of any of the other political parties. I mean, it defies whatever it defies. But I mean, of course they didn't consult anyone else because no one else would agree. And I think the EFF wouldn't agree because the EFF, whether they care or actually care or not, wants 1652 to be the date from which land can be reclaimed. Now, obviously, by going to a sort of clean, nice date like January 1800, it doesn't actually mean that means anything. I mean, clearly, I think it has the 1820 settlers in mind, possibly. But one of the funny things about this is that there is, I understand, I haven't been able to get the detail, but I understand there is a claim against the Ingonyama Trust, which is the Zulu King's, over which the Zulu King has dominion, for land taken by the Zulus from another black tribe. Now, I suspect when they put in this 1800, that hadn't occurred to them for a second that land claims actually may be about black claims on black land, etc. Because, of course, in that period, you had a lot of internecine warfare between various tribes and the Zulus, or should I say mostly the Zulus and various other tribes, and people were thrown off their lands, and the Zulu nation, who is strong and powerful, took those lands. So theoretically, those lands are going to be up for grabs, and it's going to suddenly be very uncomfortable if you're only taking lands under the stewardship of whites, not under stewardship. You're going to get into a nasty black-white argument about that. But it was clearly done to try and it's so sort of. It's not obvious, but it's so sort of messy and uncute because it was obviously intended to try and get the EFF on board. But the IFP, of course, would represent the group that from whom land would be sought. So I think it's quite funny. I think it's probably pretty much of a non-starter. That doesn't mean that the whole expropriation without compensation thing is a non-starter, but this just looks so desperate, it's almost funny.
And, I mean, I think that's a good point. We know during the Mfokane and when Shaka was king of the Zulus, there was, you know, lots of people pushed off their land. I mean, the Ndebele people in Zimbabwe are in Zimbabwe because of the violence and so on that occurred in South Africa in the 1820s or 1830s or whenever it was. That, you know, with Shaka's actions, which, I mean, he shaped Southern Africa, and probably, I mean, a lot of what he did still reverberates to this day, I think. So, Herman, would you say this is, you know, is this going to help people who are opposed to EWC, or, you know, what are the consequences of this?
I do think it might, for a few reasons. Firstly, the committee has, I think, accepted the advice of Parliament's legal constitutional experts that this sort of thing is a substantive change from the bill as it was previously considered, and therefore public participation on it must be reopened. So that gives opponents of this, you know, constitutional vandalism opportunity to again make hay out of it, build some momentum, explain it, make the arguments, and of course make submissions to Parliament. So on a purely procedural level, I think that works. On then just a narrative level, I think it's starting to expose the absolute ridiculousness of this whole thing, and we shouldn't expect foreign entities or international entities to charge to our rescue. That won't happen. But if we can be clever about this, we can use this to open the eyes of many nations, trade with whom South Africa really, really needs to maintain, that this is now beyond the absurd. And that waking up process is starting to happen. So it really puts pay to the idea that this will be done in an orderly fashion with a rule of law maintained.
Can I just make one point on that? Is Lotrit points out in her article that Mucheka is trying to sort of massage it, that the public representation, the public input, was essentially obtained because one proposer proposed this. I mean, there was one set of documents that came from an interested party, the proposer. That's not public participation. Not a bit.
It's been quite bizarre and shown, yeah, I think the bankruptcy of the ANC trying to push through this policy, which even as we've seen, people in the ANC know it's obviously it's a terrible idea, and it's not, and for whatever reason, they seem to be one push headlong for this thing. But Hammond mentioned the absurd, and something else I think we will move on to now, something that's also quite absurd, is that we know about the American withdrawal in Afghanistan. But it seems that they basically, the American withdrawal, they left a lot of equipment behind in Afghanistan. And it seems now that the Taliban is possibly one of the most best equipped armies in the world. But is this something to worry about? Because I don't think that the Taliban has got all that many qualified pilots who can fly Black Hawk helicopters or, you know, state-of-the-art fighter jets that the Americans left there. But is this something to be concerned about, Soro? Is this something that's getting blown out of proportion? Or is this going to be bad for the region? Is this going to cause more instability there?
Well, I think you said that it makes the Taliban the fourth most armed governing body.
They have the fourth most attack helicopters in the world now, I believe.
It's got Black Hawk helicopters, it's got ND-530 helicopters, it's got MI-17 helicopters, it's got Hercules. I mean, those the huge transport planes. Now, I don't think the Taliban's going to use that stuff anytime soon, but it never needed to. I mean, essentially, it ran through Afghanistan with what we would consider fairly basic arms, and there are hundreds or tens of thousands of grenades, very useful. You've got grenade launchers, they've got, no problem. You've got Humvees, which are protective people carriers. They've got minesweepers. Those things they should be able to operate. And, you know, they've also, I think, in having an ally like Pakistan and China sort of looking cozy and Russia, I think they could give assistance if they needed it with regards to the stuff that should be flown. So while it may not be necessary to use immediately, there's a lot of stuff they can use immediately that they are equipped to use if they need it. But essentially, they won't really need anything unless and until resistance really picks up, and then some of the stuff could be really really problematic. I mean, they're talking about if you're looking at the one area of resistance, the Tajiks in I can't remember the name of their valley, but there, if you send in a helicopter or a small attack plane with some armaments, you can do very quick damage and probably wipe them out. So I think the fact that it is available to them is, you know, I wouldn't be too chuffed about it. The other thing, of course, is it's just visually and sort of aesthetically, it is such an embarrassment for the US to leave such functional, lots of such functional equipment. It kind of, it deepens the embarrassment level of having pulled out so ignominiously.
Let me come to you, Aaron. So what does this mean for the region? And do you think that this is going to be, is this going to affect President Joe Biden in any way in the long term? It seems that even his allies in the US are kind of turning on him for this, you know, the shambolic way that the Americans pulled out of Afghanistan. I mean, do you think there could be, I mean, could we see, you know, this used as an excuse to maybe remove him from office? Is it possible we're going to have President Kamala Harris in 2022?
I think that's a bit of a stretch. I do think that Biden's just absolutely incompetent handling of this evacuation really, really damaged the Democrats at a time when they wanted to use the political win, as it were, the political capital from finally ending a multi-decade war, as it could be considered, heading into the midterm elections. In 2022, and you're already seeing congressional candidates on the Democratic ticket who wanted to use what they considered to be the electoral assets of Joe Biden, you know, his seniority, his stability, his, you know, just not being Trump, you know, the adult in the room from their perspective. They wanted to use that going into the midterms. And that is now clearly no longer working out well. You are seeing Democratic candidates, you know, putting distance between themselves and the White House on this. And I do think it's a political gamble that's going to backfire on the Democrats, because for all the, you know, the anti-war sentiment, there's this weird, almost paradoxical idea of American pride and the American military that still carries in middle America and even in the middle America parts of Democratic America. Or purple America, you know, some political currency. If you embarrass the troops, if you embarrass the U.S. Army, politically, you really start bleeding capital. And I do think that we're going to see that happening to Joe Biden, and the Democrats trying to distance themselves from him is, I think, evidence of that. But I do think, regionally speaking, I can't really bring myself to think that the Taliban has interest in using many of these weapons, but I definitely think they have interest in selling them or providing them to people for, you know, in exchange for some protection. So my real concern would be, and I think people in the comment section is exposing or pointing to this, is what Iran will do with this, because it might funnel these weapons to you know, Pakistan or aggressive regimes or regimes that are so porous that they become hotspots for terror bases from which to attack Western interests or American interests. So that which the Taliban cannot use, they will most definitely barter. So whether they have the skills to fly, whatever jets or whatever helicopters, I think is a bit beside the point. These are valuable assets that can be used against, the great Shaitan, America, America's satellites, the West and Europe, and, you know, the decadence of it all. But I do think that this is a shambolic mishandling that three presidents must be responsible for. Despite popular opinion or general common sense, the Afghanistan war was a relatively successful one. The Taliban was deposed, the Americans came in, and it was relatively successful. You don't have to agree with military dovishness or military hawkishness to think that the Afghanistan war went as well as a war in the 21st century possibly could go for America. Iraq is a completely different story. I mean, you just have to read the biographies of, your Rumsfelds, your Cheneys, your Condoleezza Rices, your George W. Bushes to understand that Iraq was essentially just, a humanitarian pass the parcel of immense proportions, that the State Department wanted to do one thing and the military wanted to do another. And if anything went wrong, they just stepped back. So you had these three centers of power, the White House, the State Department, and the Pentagon, wanting to do their own thing in Iraq, but not wanting to expend the resources that they want, that they need in their departments. So it just became an absolute lack of accountability, and that led to disaster. Afghanistan was different. Afghanistan had reliable elections. It stabilized. Women's rights actually became something resembling what Iran was in the 1960s and very, very early 70s. By no means was it this great, glorious civilization, but it wasn't the 15th century caliphate that it is now likely to become. And the blame for that, despite George Bush instigating that war, I don't think falls with him. It falls with Barack Obama, it falls with Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo, who negotiated with the Taliban some really awful agreements. And of course, it lays most dramatically and emphatically at the feet of Joe Biden, who could have seen this coming had he only had, the 47 contact lenses in that his, relatively geriatric eyes needed to see the wood for the trees.
yeah, it's not a good situation for the Afghanistan people, and I've seen some horrific footage coming out there of the summer executions and so on, and I actually saw footage of a Afghanistan TV presenter hosting a debate or something, and there were two Taliban standing behind them, armed. So obviously making sure he wasn't going to say, obviously I don't know how recent the footage was. I unfortunately can't speak any Pashto or Urdu, whatever the language is that is mainly spoken in Afghanistan. But yeah, it's not a good situation. And I think it's, you know, maybe future historians might be looking back at this and seeing this is when we finally saw the end of the American empire, the beginning of the end at least. And then moving to our last topic, we've got a bit of time for it. Cyril Ramaphosa said that we need to strengthen laws and policies protecting whistleblowers after the killing of this poor woman in the Gauteng Health Department, Babita Diokaran. She was killed last week by apparently four or five hitmen, maybe even more. So this seems to be one of these things where there are policies that exist. I mean, murder is illegal in South Africa. So, I mean, what more... I mean, what is the president talking about, Jan? What can be done?
I think it's a classic case of our government, which loves to legislate instead of rule, instead of govern. You don't need masses. There is legislation about whistleblowing, but you don't need masses of legislation to protect whistleblowers. You need a police service and an MPA that is prepared to and has the budget to protect witnesses. I mean, or whistleblowers rather, but much the same. The ANC in general and Ramaphosa in particular, they love to legislate a seeming response to a crisis or an answer to a problem, when what you actually need them to do, which they're not very good at doing, is exploiting the laws they already have. And it's properly funding the entities that have got that should apply those laws. You know, I don't believe you have to have laws that the police need or the MPA need to say, okay, if we've got laws 1, 2, 3, and 4 or sections 1, 2, 3, and 4, we can go and protect a whistleblower. I mean, it's an operational thing. It should be part of your discretion and the need, and given our country, the need for protection of whistleblowers, just do it. The question is, can they do it? Do they have the resources to do it? That, you know, all of that comes into play. But to legislate, I mean, legislation is nothing if it isn't acted upon properly, and we don't act upon anything properly.
Herman, do you have anything to add to what Tara said?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Our president is either intellectually, you know, falling short of a slug, or as removed from reality as a prawn, because exactly which policy or piece of legislation would have protected Babita Diokaran? I mean, the bullets that you know killed her wouldn't have stopped because some policy was different or some piece of law had been passed and signed by a bunch of out of touch politicians. What would have protected her is if there wasn't a bloody whistle to blow in the first place. This idea that the state can protect people by like Diokaran means that in some way you want to protect their identity. Or I don't know, what's the policy going to be that's going to protect this? Is it going to protect their identity? My word, it's the state that is killing these people because these people are acting against the interests of these bloody predator politicians. Which policy in this man's possibly, you know, cupcake-like, pseudo-intellectual, grunpen jogging mind would have saved this woman's life? I just want to ask the president, how on earth can he seriously look this woman's family in the eye and say it was anything other than his party that killed her? It wasn't a policy that could have saved her. The only thing that could have saved her was if cowardly politicians like Cyril Ramaphosa didn't give cause for people to having to blow the bloody whistle by, you know, trying to protect a vulnerable people against a hyena, predator, vulture government. I'm sorry, I should not get up, worked up about it, but it's bloody annoying.
I think you're spot on there, Herman. The ANC itself and by extension the state is basically a mafia organization and basically exists just to extract rents and so on, not really to govern anymore. So we've seen what happened to this poor woman, and condolences to her family, obviously. And let's hope that the people get brought to justice and they pay the price for this. But that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to everybody who's listening and watching. You can obviously catch all our work at dailyfriend.co.za. You can also, if you want to support the work of the Institute of Race Relations, SMS your name to 32823. It's also an option on the Institute of Race Relations website and the Daily Friend to support us. Thanks. And Nick Longmer might be back tomorrow. I'm not too sure what his health status is, but yeah. Hopefully he'll be in studying tomorrow. So thanks everybody. See you tomorrow.